You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. And now tonight we welcome Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie in conversation with Faith Adeyele. Chimamanda is the author of three novels. Her first, Purple Hibiscus, was set in post-colonial Nigeria. Her second, Half a Yellow Sun, about the Biafran War, won the UK's Orange Prize. She's also the author of a collection of short stories, The Thing Around Your Neck, which was shortlisted for the 2010 Commonwealth Writers Prize. Chimamanda lives between Nigeria and the United States, and her new novel, Americana, moves among three countries, Nigeria, the United States, and England. It follows Ifemelu, a young Nigerian woman who moves to the U.S. and finds a certain kind of fame writing candidly about race and nationality on an anonymous blog she names Race Teenth or Various Observations About American Blacks, Those Formerly Known as Negroes by a Non-American Black, in which the author dissects everything from white guys with dreadlocks to the president's popularity with women from African and Caribbean nations. Adichie has said that it was her fellow countryman, the late great Nigerian writer Chinwe Achebe, who gave the confidence that people like her, a girl of Igbo descent, could exist in novels. In fact, Adichie, the fifth of six children, grew up in a house that Achebe once lived in, which is quite an amazing story. Tonight, Chimamanda is joined by Faith Adeyele, with whom she also has overlapping history, which I'm sure we'll hear about tonight. This is the first time they've been united in an onstage conversation. Faith is the author of the critically acclaimed memoir, Meeting Faith, An Account of Becoming Thailand's First Black Buddhist Nun. Faith was the writer, narrator, and subject of the PBS documentary My Journey Home, which is based on her life growing up with a Nordic American single mother and then traveling to Nigeria as an adult to find her father and siblings. She just finished up her term teaching as a distinguished writer at Mills College, and she's wrapping up another memoir, Twins Growing Up Nigerian Nordic American, which is a great title. Please join me in welcoming Chimamanda and Faith to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Good evening. Thank you all so much for coming. It's very lovely to be here. And it's particularly lovely to share a stage with my friend Faith. I'm going to read a short excerpt from Americana before Faith and I have a conversation and before we have a conversation with you. So I'm hoping that we can talk about the weather and about my hair. Not about the book, that's no point. No. So I'll read from the beginning of Americana. Princeton in the summer smelled of nothing. And although Ifemelu liked the tranquil greenness of the many trees, the clean streets and stately homes, the delicately overpriced shops, and the quiet abiding air of earned grace, it was this, the lack of a smell, that most appealed to her. Perhaps because the other American cities she knew well had all smelled distinctly. Philadelphia had the musty scent of history. New Haven smelled of neglect. Baltimore smelled of brine. And Brooklyn of sun-warmed garbage. But Princeton had no smell. She liked taking deep breaths here. She liked watching the locals who drove with pointed courtesy and parked their latest model cars outside the organic grocery store on Nassau Street, or outside the sushi restaurants, or outside the ice cream shop that had 50 different flavors, including red pepper. Or outside the post office where effusive staff bounded out to greet them at the entrance. She liked the campus, grave with knowledge, the Gothic buildings with their vine-laced walls, and the way everything transformed in the half-light of night into a ghostly scene. She liked most of all that in this place of affluent ease, she could pretend to be someone else, someone specially admitted into a hallowed American club, someone adorned with certainty. But she did not like that she had to go to Trenton to braid her hair. It was unreasonable to expect a braiding salon in Princeton. The few black locals she had seen were so light-skinned and lank-haired, she could not imagine them wearing braids. And yet, as she waited at Princeton Junction Station for the train, on an afternoon ablaze with heat, she wondered why there was no place where she could braid her hair. The chocolate bar in her handbag had melted. A few other people were waiting on the platform, all of them white and lean, in short, flimsy clothes. The man standing closest to her was eating an ice cream cone. She had always found it a little irresponsible, the eating of ice cream cones by grown-up American men. Especially the eating of ice cream cones by grown-up American men in public. He turned to her and said, "About time," when the train finally creaked in, with the familiarity that strangers adopt with each other after sharing in the disappointment of a public service. She smiled at him. The graying hair on the back of his head was swept forward, a comical arrangement to disguise his bald spot. He had to be an academic, but not in the humanities, or he would be more self-conscious. A firm science like chemistry, maybe. Before, she would have said, "I know," that peculiar American expression that professed agreement rather than knowledge. And then she would have started a conversation with him to see if he would say something she could use in her blog. People were flattered to be asked about themselves. And if she said nothing after they spoke, it made them say more. If they asked what she did, she would say vaguely, "I write a lifestyle blog." Because saying, "I write an anonymous blog called Race Teenth, or Various Observations About American Blacks, Those Formerly Known as Negroes, by a Non-American Black," would make them uncomfortable. She had said it, though, a few times. Once, to a dreadlocked white man who sat next to her on the train, his hair like old twine ropes that ended in a blonde fuzz. His tattered shirt worn with enough piety to convince her that he was a social warrior and might make a good guest blogger. Race is totally overhyped these days. Black people need to get over themselves. It's all about class now, the haves and the have-nots, he told her evenly. And she used it as the opening sentence of a blog post titled, "Not all dreadlocked white American guys are down." Then there was the man from Ohio who was squeezed next to her on a flight, a middle manager, she was sure, from his boxy suit and his contrast color. He wanted to know what she meant by lifestyle blog, and she told him, expecting him to become reserved or to end the conversation by saying something defensively bland like, "The only race that matters is the human race." But he said, "Ever write about adoption? Nobody wants black babies in this country, and I don't mean biracial, I mean black. Even the black families don't want them." He told her that he and his wife had adopted a black child, and their neighbors looked at them as though they had chosen to become martyrs for a dubious cause. Her blog post about him, titled "Badly Dressed White Middle Managers from Ohio Are Not Always What You Think," had received the highest number of comments for that month. She still wondered if he had read it. She hoped so. Often she would sit in cafes or airports or train stations, watching strangers, imagining their lives, and wondering which of them were likely to have read her blog. Thank you.
Forgotten how far we're supposed to take these. Is this right? Now I can't see my notes. Thank you so much. Welcome to everyone. Thank you so much for coming out. And thank you to everybody here at the Library Foundation, Louise, and Maureen, Sarah, and of course to Chimamanda. You'll see I have my long Nigerian-style questions, which are, in fact, little speeches about me at the end, which I'll say, now, what do you think?
That's a bit worrying. We don't want her to do the Nigerian-style questions because they...
They take all night. I know, but I was afraid I'd forget because there are so many things about this book that I'm really excited about. But one of the things that occurred to me when we were reading, I think the last time I saw you was 2 years ago in Lagos, and you said you were going to try to write something funny. And I think actually it was this train scene. We were like, can she do it? Exactly. But it's just so interesting because you said, you know, the first book, Purple Hibiscus, grew out of homesickness for Nigeria when you were in the U.S. And then, of course, you said you cried for most of the time while you were writing Half of a Yellow Sun, you know, because it's about the Nigerian-Biafran War, which is kind of the central traumatic event of our parents' generation. But you've said you were laughing the entire time that you were writing Americana, which must be kind of lovely.
It was mostly, yes.
Yes.
I mean, it's not that it wasn't necessarily an easy book to write, just that parts of it were just fun.
Right.
And in some ways, it was a new experience for me because I'm not used to laughing while I write. So it was nice to have that.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Well, and I think the humor really helps with this satire where pretty much everybody gets it. And I love how everybody gets it. And when I was reading this book, it was really a revelation for me because so many things that I had observed and thought, like, am I the only one who's noticing this? Like, isn't this a little strange? I can't say anything because I'm kind of an outsider, insider. So it was so lovely to be given permission to say, you know, like, these Nigerian expats are crazy. You know, this stuff is nuts. So thank you for that. But I was wondering about the whole idea of satire because there's a, you know, a long tradition of it in the West. And oftentimes social criticism had to be, you know, hidden as satire even. Mm. But I was wondering if you called upon any kind of Nigerian storytelling forms for that, the kind of mockery and wordplay that happens, you know, in Nigerian life. And I was thinking, I've read a lot about the Aba women's war and how they did this practice of like sitting on a man. Mm-hmm. And I was just wondering if that influenced kind of how, your approach.
Not consciously, no. I don't know. But I think all my work is influenced by something. Right? But I don't know what the conscious influences are, and I'm not even sure I want to know.
Mm-hmm.
So when I set out to write this book, all I just thought was I want to write the kind of book that I want to read. And of course, we both know that there's a strong tradition of that in some ways that mockery is an art form in Nigeria.
Yes.
And so, and it's something that I do fairly well in my life.
Be careful.
So I'm sure that it's found its way into this book. I mean, I often say that sometimes I get angry at how in Nigeria people just make fun of everything. People find humor in just the most absurd things.
Right.
And sometimes I wish we would laugh less.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because then I think, I wonder if all the laughter is the reason we're not fixing our problems.
Right, but, there's that.
But I'm sure that that...
Nigerians in the house.
I'm sure. Niger peeps. But I'm sure that tradition of sort of Nigerian poking fun at things must have come into this book. But I didn't consciously set out to sort of, you know, emulate or be influenced by any particular forms. No.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Not that I know. Maybe we should, shouldn't we tell them the story of how we know each other?
Certainly. I think we have a couple of versions, so you can tell yours.
They're all true.
Just like my husband and I, we have different versions.
Yeah. Truth is all relative. So I grew up in Nsukka, which is a small university town. And when I was in primary school in Nsukka, and primary school was actually where I learned everything I know today. So I went to a wonderful, really, this is true. I stopped learning in grade 6. But my one of my closest friends in primary school was Adanna Adiele, who, Adanna was known not only for being very beautiful, but she had very thick, long hair. So we would all like to play with Adanna's hair. This is true in grade 2 and grade 3. And then, yeah, I remember maybe when I was in secondary school, reading Ebony or Essence.
Essence.
And then seeing something about the Adiele family. And I thought, wait, what? Because, of course, at the time, reading American magazines, particularly Essence and Ebony, were sort of highlights for people like me. And then it turned out that there was an article about the Adiele family and that they had an American sister. And her name was Faith Adiele. And there's a picture of her, and I was stunned at how much she looked like Adanna. And so it turns out that this wasn't an assistant. And I didn't get to meet, but of course I knew about Faith because I'd read that article, but I didn't get to meet her until many years later. And so it was kind of, when I finally met her, I said, I've known your story. Oh, and then I read her book years later before I met her.
Before?
And
wow.
Yeah, I'd read you.
You're good.
So it was just, really, and then Faith came, and we spent some time in Lagos together, and I remember teasing her and saying, you're the Adiele daughter who was raised in America, but the Igbo gene in you is very strong, because she had all of these opinions about the people in her village who were trying to, how she was really tough, and she had this strong Igbo woman, fierce, I don't take rubbish, and I was, and I thought, oh my Lord, these genes are strong. So anyway, so it's nice to share the stage with my Igbo sister.
Thank you. That's so funny because I'm always terrified when I'm in Nigeria.
Really? Remember when you were telling me that story? Well, anyway.
It's interesting. The story around that, it was, I was raised here and I met my family when I was 26 and we took that photo and it was interesting because I didn't write about it for a long time and then we were preparing to go back to Nigeria with PBS to make a documentary and Essence had just sent me that article and I just happened to have it in my bag because when we got there, the fixer wasn't there. There was nobody to help us at the airport. There were just a bunch of military guys with their arms folded looking really fat and happy at us with all our camera equipment. And so they were like, who are you? What's going on? You're smuggling. They were going to, put us in jail for sure. And then finally the cameraman said, this is all her fault. It's all about her. And so they all turned to me and they're like, who are you? And I luckily I had the Essence article. So I whipped it out. Thank God I had remembered. And so they all sat down and they read with their little fingers across aloud, all the little generals. And there was one Igbo among all of them. And he was so happy and puffed up and proud. And so then they called the porters and they, carried
there
our bags
go.
For us when we got in. So thank God for that article.
This is how to survive. The trick is to make sure that there's an article about you. And actually, make sure you have
magazine.
A Nigerian parent.
Yes, have a Nigerian parent. Always carry an article, something like that. So, yeah. So then I heard about you and I was looking for you. So I went to Nsukka. I went to your house. We were knocking on the door. Nobody was there. And then finally.
Did you really?
Yeah. Yeah. Because I'd heard about you. So I was I must find you. So we did a little pilgrimage, that terrifying drive from Enugu to Nsukka and went knocking on your door. And then later I found you at a wedding.
Around
the pool.
Yes. Yeah, right. Okay, let's talk about the book now, yeah.
That is apropos of nothing.
Just useful background information.
Exactly. And clearly I didn't get Adana's hair.
Yeah. I'm not saying anything.
I know. I think we need to talk about hair. I was going to leave it alone because every single review I've read starts with that scene. And I'm like, there are 475 other pages, my friends, but they all talk about that scene, and I find that really interesting. But you've called it a novel about love, race, and hair, which I think is really wonderful. And of course, there's the traditional story of love interrupted, but there's all sorts of other love too. I thought it was a bit of a love letter to Nsukka, to that kind of multicultural university community. And then there's Ifemelu's journey to kind of love her hair, which I think you might relate to. I saw you on some Nigerian program saying, I've fallen in love with my hair now that I know all that it can do. And the woman anchor was not having it. She was like, no.
Oh, right. Yes, I remember that, actually. I walked into the studio. This is a TV station in Lagos. And she said to me, how do you handle that? And she meant my hair. She sort of, what do you do with that?
That was so interesting. But... yes, this conversation is a hard one to have about hair. So I think it's interesting how you're putting the personal and the political there together, and kind of the love as being part of that struggle.
Yeah, and you're right about. I think also Americana is, it's about love. It's me wanting to write this unapologetic, lush, and slightly ridiculous love story in the manner of love stories, because I like love stories of that sort. But also it's love of reading. I think this book is also about just the love of books. How Obinze loves books, how he makes Ifemelu come to love books. It's a love for home. You're right. Nsukka is a town that means so much to me, and I think in some way all of my work is about Nsukka and about...
Really?
And I think of the slight romanticizing of my childhood.
Definitely.
This was a very happy childhood.
Yeah, exactly.
And Ifemelu, not just coming to love her hair, but also just coming to love the the most authentic version of herself. Mm-hmm. I see this book as Ifemelu shedding the layers of falseness as she moves, sort of as we watch her grow and change. And hair is part of it. And, you know, hair, I'm interested in hair. I wanted to write about hair. And when lots of people have said, well, why hair? And I think if I wrote about baseball, nobody would ask me why baseball.
Right.
But somehow when you write about natural black, it's like, why? Well, why not? It's interesting. And also, I think it's very layered. I'm interested in hair on the level of hair. Mm-hmm. But also on the meanings, really, and the layers that it has. I want to say that the reason I started to wear my hair natural was because I had this moment of self-realization and black pride. But really, I didn't. I just stopped because I hated what the relaxer had done to my scalp. Right, so that's really why. I'd come to the U.S. I couldn't afford to go to a hair salon. I thought it was ridiculously expensive to get a relaxer. And so I went and I bought the thing in the drugstore and I did it myself. And it was a disaster because, you know, in Nigeria, I was used to going to a hair salon. And suddenly I have to put this thing on my scalp. And I came out with numerous little burns on my scalp. And I just remember thinking, why am I doing this? And I won't do this anymore. And it actually took a long time, but it didn't mean that I then immediately liked my natural hair, because I didn't. Mm. No, I would still hide it, braid it, that sort of thing. And so it took a while for me to come to like it and then to love it. And now I am obsessed. It's ridiculous. The reason it took me, I have to say, the reason it took me 5 years to finish this novel is because I spent 4.5 years watching YouTube videos of natural hair. I think the women here with natural hair know what I'm talking about. That's right. There's an incredible subculture.
I didn't know that.
Oh, Lord. I recommend it to everyone. Please. Male, female, white, black, Asian, other. Please go and watch this. Just Google natural black hair on YouTube and you see these women who... It's really an incredible subculture. And for me, there was something almost anthropological about watching these things. So I was collecting material. I said, these women who... It's a journey. Because I think many black women grew up thinking their hair is a problem to be solved.
Right.
It's something one has to do something about. And not even really knowing how to care for it in its natural form. And so I think that the subculture represents a kind of a growing awareness and acceptance of who we are. Mm-hmm. So you have these women who, you know, they put the computer camera and like, hey, this is this is so you have to this it's true, isn't it? This is Takiya coming at you from Atlanta. and then they're like and then they raise the thing, they're like, this is the shea butter that I used. And then they turn around and show you the hair. And this thing goes on, and I just keep watching. It's terrible. That's why the novel took so long to write. I like to pretend that I was researching and revising, but that's not true. I was just watching YouTube.
Oh, my goodness. That's so much better than the internet cat videos I've been watching for the last 5 years. Oh, my God. That's fantastic. I want to talk a little bit about another town that you wanted to write about other than Nsukka was also Lagos.
Yeah.
And, you know, you said you wanted to write about contemporary Lagos and how it's changed in the last 15 years. So, you know, the perfect device of having someone who's returned from having been gone for such a long time. And, you know, the title Americana refers to someone who's, you know, been outside and has come back with kind of all these affectations. You forget how to speak your mother tongue and all this sort of rubbish. And when I was reading it, it was really reminding me of my father's return, because he had been gone for 13 years, went back in 1965, but he was part of that first generation that was being primed, you know, for independence, and they were so optimistic. And I remember his letters just raving about, like, the fantastic rate at which Nigeria was changing. You know, he said that, you know, what took the U.S. and Britain 100 years to accomplish, we're doing in 5. You know, they believed all this stuff. So I was, you know, kind of wondering, what are the parallels? What are you seeing happening in Lagos right now that kind of speaks to what the next renaissance or, you know, the next stage for Nigeria is?
I think Lagos is a city that sort of it takes 2 steps forward and 1 step back, and that's the sort of the Lagos's trajectory, I think, is what that's the form it takes. It's a city that I love, but it's also a city that I realize... In Americana, there's a scene in which I make fun, but, you know, in a good way, loving
with
fun
love.
Of the returnee class.
Yes.
And I should say that actually Americana is also... there's a lot of Americana that's about self-mockery because I'm really poking fun of my various tribes. Mm. So the returnee group in Nigeria, the people who left and went to the US or to the UK to get educated and then moved back... that's in some ways my tribe, because I'm comfortable in that circle. As I am in the US, I also make fun of the sort of slightly precious academic American, which is also my American tribe, because many of my friends, many of my American friends are often academic types who care about organic pomegranate juice.
Yes.
And that is my tribe, that's my circle, but I poke fun at it because I think that while I too care about organic pomegranate juice, I think that it's important to realize there's a vast world out there that doesn't care about that sort of thing. and that it's important to sort of know that and to make fun of that. So I think that the idea of Lagos being taken on its own terms is something that I'm not sure that the returnee class often does. So people come back to Lagos and they complain about how Lagos is not like New York. But then Lagos is never going to be like New York, right? So I think that I think progress has been made since the military fell. I mean, you know, since we got the democracy of sorts, there's, you know, our economic liberalization, there's a growing middle class. Lagos has immense ambition. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think maybe a bit too much ambition, but, you know, people talk about cable cars. I'm like, okay, let's all calm down and get electricity first before we start talking about cable cars. But even just that, there's this sense of can-do-ness of, you know, now we're building Atlantic City and all of that. And I suppose all of that is good. So I guess that's one way to measure progress. Mm-hmm. Maybe another way would be, I don't know. But yeah, Lagos is...
You do know.
I'll stop there.
Okay. That's interesting. I loved the opportunity to spend time in Lagos with all those different subcultures. And one of the things that I've always enjoyed about your work is how you don't make concessions to a Western audience. You just throw us in, you know, in the midst of Nigerian idiom and slang and Igbo phrases and, you know, references to politicians and penal code and pop culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all that stuff that usually ethnic writers are told not to include, either in their writing workshops or by their agents or their publishers, but that makes, you know, the life so vibrant. And I think it's just a matter of kind of teaching one's audience how to read it, I think.
Yeah, and I also think, I mean, I have friends in Nigeria, for example, who say to me, how do Americans understand this? Mm-hmm. Because they think it's so Nigerian, especially the Nigerian bits. And you know, the agents and editors who will sometimes tell you, oh, take that out because Americans. I don't think we give readers enough... We should have more confidence in our readers. Mm-hmm. I certainly do. Because, you know, when I was growing up, I read these books about Russia. And sometimes I didn't know what the heck some of the things were, but it didn't get in the way of my understanding and falling in love with characters and following the story. And I don't think I would have wanted a sanitized version of Russia. I wanted to, you know, and it's such a shame. And I try very hard when I teach my writing workshops to tell my students, don't do that. Don't start off thinking your audience needs you to give them a watered down version of your world. They don't. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also that thing where for those of us, right, who are sort of on the periphery of things, we just need to have a greater confidence and stop being apologetic about realities. And mm-hmm. I think that readers will get it. I think so.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
And that's one of the wonderful things of literature, is that opportunity to travel and go someplace else. Just once you allow yourself to not be freaked, oh, there's a foreign word, you know, to really enter. And then you feel smarter when you're done. You know? So that's fantastic. But you've mentioned how, like, Nigerian readers aren't as interested in all kind of the racial commentary that you've got going on. Mm. They're excited about the characters, of course, because they recognize these people. And, you know, they want to know what happened to them. And I see that your publisher in Nigeria has got, you know, they've been tweeting, asking readers, like, who their favorite characters are.
Really?
Yes. There's so many. There hasn't been, like, a critical mass. No one's won at this point. But I thought that that was an interesting approach, was through the characters. And so I was asking myself, who's my favorite character? And I have to say, the person who was the greatest revelation for me, who I'm most haunted by, was this Auntie Uju. Yeah. And I think it's because her kind of tragedy is her limits of imagination. And it seemed to me that there are many characters who are like that. There's Efemlu's mother, who's kind of, you know, disappeared into religion, which we could call a Nigerian pathology, perhaps. You know, there's
some Nigerians here are thinking, what pathology? What? Wait, what?
That's code for everything's fine. There's, you know, there's the white woman that she works for, you know. And then I was thinking, you know, I've seen this motif, I think, maybe in Purple Hibiscus and half of a Yellow Sun, too, as well, that there are these women who have these limitations, and sometimes they're external, they're societal or class-based. But a lot of times they're internal, and I think we could even say that Hair Decisions could be read that way, as a lack of imagination and a kind of an acceptance of, you know, society's standards of beauty. And I was just wondering how you, like, what are some of the inspirations for your women characters, and how do you learn to understand someone who has these limitations?
I think we all do. All I have to do is look inward at my own many limitations. But I think that's actually a very interesting reading, that it's really in the end a failure of imagination. But again, even the ability of imagination to stretch itself is conditioned by your reality. I mean, I think it takes the rare person to be able to transcend all of what society tells you is normal and good. Mm-hmm. And it takes extra strength. It's hard. And, you know, I think Auntie Uju, and you're, actually, yes, because in some ways Auntie Uju is similar to... Auntie Uju is a woman... I'm interested in women like her. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in women who make choices that from looking outside, looking from outside, we think, well, why would she? So she's intelligent, she's a doctor. Why does she choose to be with this man who's married, who she knows can never give her more than he is giving her?
Right.
And I don't know. I mean, I don't know the answers. People, I mean, this is also the other thing about the human impulse isn't always logical.
Right.
Definitely. It just isn't. And I'm very interested in that, in the way we make choices, and it's not as though, you know, in the way that pop psychology today is, we're all supposed to know why. So, you know, you do something and they tell you, oh, that's because your mother didn't give you that hug when you were 10. But it's actually not necessarily that. Sometimes it's just that we're human, and to be human is a messy thing. And
very messy.
Yeah, and I, in particular women, because I'm very interested in women's lives and also in how the options we give and don't give women shape the way they start to look at themselves. I'm struck, for example, by how when I'm in Nigeria and I talk about feminism, the greatest pushback I get is from women.
Really?
Yeah. It's from educated women, very well educated, mostly affluent women. Wow. And I'm very interested in that because I don't have the answers, but yeah. So many women, and also just the women in my own life that I grew up, you know, with a mother who didn't do that. You're a girl, go to the kitchen. You're a boy, go and play. Mm-hmm. So we all did the same things, and I think that was very important for me, for me growing up and my formation and all of that. But then I also had aunts but even my own mother, who in many ways is the strong, independent woman, who, you know, big woman in the university and made decisions. But then I remember also that sometimes she would say things like, "A woman needs to know when to step aside and let the man be the head," that sort of thing. Where I would think, or I remember we had a relative who wanted to leave her husband because she was very unhappy. Her husband was abusive and all of that. And I was just struck by my mother saying to her, just stay there. Stay there. You're married already. What will you just stay? But that's not, it's the norm. And I'm sure you know this, right?
Yes,
it's that idea that a woman's worth is measured by whether or not she's married.
Yes.
It's not about, you know, does he beat you? Well, maybe you should try and make him not beat you anymore. Right?
do you feel unfulfilled? Well, just manage because you have a husband and many people don't. And that kind of thinking for women who in many ways have other choices, but they're limited by that thinking. So it's not so much that the logistics of leaving is impossible. It's here. And I'm very interested in that. So, and I think a lot of my work is about that. And Auntie Ju is that kind of woman.
Yeah.
And even she comes to the U.S. and she suddenly decides, okay, I want to have another child. And so I'm just going to go with...
Yes.
We don't want to give anything away for people who have... People who
You'll want to know. Yeah, that, it's her reversal is so heartbreaking, and just the precariousness of her situation. I mean, yeah. I was very fascinated by that class of women. I think you say women who have no recognizable source of wealth or something like that, you know. And I've always been kind of fascinated, slightly horrified by this whole class of women, particularly the young girls. But then to see how precarious her situation was, and a situation like that happened recently to a. An in-law of mine too, you know, where they came and kicked her out of the house, and I was just like, it really hit home, and you know, it's real risk-taking to live that life.
Yeah, but also in many ways that it's a choice she makes. But, right. I mean, we can argue about, you know, how much of a choice does she really have? But in some ways, it's still a choice. Mm-hmm. It's still a choice, and it's something I find very interesting.
I used to the first time I went to Nigeria, the way I read it, and I'm not sure if I read it correctly, but it just seemed to me that women had both the burden that came with traditional society of having, you know, having to marry and having to bear a son and having to, you know, cook soup for your husband and stuff like that. But then they were also supposed to get PhDs and fabulous jobs too. So I was like,
that is true. That is true. But that is very true. But they're supposed to. Women are encouraged to be ambitious and to go to school. But there's a limit to that. So you're supposed to be ambitious, but don't be too ambitious. Mm. And you're supposed to go get a job and earn a living, but make sure you do not earn anything close to what your husband earns. Okay. And in addition to that, of course, you really have to know that your first job is to produce children and to raise them. And it's a very interesting thing because we're quite selective in when we choose to use culture to silence women.
Right.
Because, you know, so we want to send them off and, you know, men now say, I want to marry a medical doctor. That's sort of the classic thing in Nigeria, right?
We know why.
So they want that, but then at the same time, if this medical doctor decides that she wants to have an equal say, then he remembers how it's not our culture. So it's actually very interesting. But then, of course, nobody wonders whether, is it our culture for her to then be a medical doctor? I mean, shouldn't she, I don't know.
Farm. That's really interesting. It's wonderful. Okay, I think we do have to talk a little bit about race.
Do we have to talk about it in whispers?
Yes. Because we're in America. No, I was really interested in the device of the blog. I thought that was just a really kind of fun way to do it. And I was also wondering how much insurance it was, because it was like... I didn't write it. Emily wrote it. You know these characters, how they get unruly and do what they want to do. So I just thought that was a really interesting way that we have this kind of, you know, story within a story, and it's written in such a different voice. It's so sassy and, you know, really fabulous. But I couldn't help but notice some parallels between how, you know, when you came to the U.S., you weren't aware, you know, of race, and you found out, you know, no one asked me if I wanted to be black when I got here. You just are. So that you have, you know, this idea of having to learn race and having to learn what it means to, and the politics of identification and how to read racism and when to get upset and how to, you know, all that sort of thing. You know, you learn to become obsessed with it because you have to be.
Yeah.
And I had a very similar experience. You know, I grew up with, you know, the white half of my family, and I was the only black girl, mixed girl in my town. And so when I went to college in Boston, which is a very, very segregated town, all of a sudden I had to know how to be black. And I would always imagine myself as kind of this Afro-Viking, as my friend Heidi Durow calls it, in exile in Eastern Washington, just waiting for my people to come pick me up.
The Afro-Viking. That should be a title of a novel.
The ship never arrived. You know, so then you get to these places where they have all these expectations and... you know, and then they're disappointed that your beautiful surname turns out not to be Italian or French as they'd imagined, and that you're just a little black girl.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Yeah, so I was just wondering about the development of this device, of the secondary narrative, the blog to do the sly commentary.
I'm very amused at what you said about it, about how you wondered whether it might be insurance.
I hadn't thought about that. But I mean, I think, and it's also interesting to me that many people have read this to be my opinion, which I find very interesting, because I wonder whether it's not so much what I've said as what I'm talking about. So if I had written this book and all of these opinions were about baseball, I wonder if people would say, this is what Adichie thinks about baseball.
Right.
I think it would be more, this is what the character says. But I think because race is such a thing, race is so layered and contested and complicated that it's very easy to attribute them to me. If Emily is not me, she really isn't. Right. She's a lot more interesting than I am. And really she is. And I admire her, actually. I like that she's prickly and fun. Many of the things that she writes about, I agree with, but not all.
Right.
But it's also that I wanted to, I don't know that it's so much insurance as it is. It's difficult to write. I thought this was the best way to do it. I wanted to be able to write about something that I take quite seriously, which is race in America, but also that I find funny. I mean, I think there's a lot that's so absurd.
Right.
Not just about the way race has been constructed in America, but also the way people deal with it. I mean, even the way that you said, no, we have to talk about race, right? And the way that you know, that for example, there's a section in the book that was actually from my life, which is I had just come to the U.S., been here maybe a month, and went out to a store with a friend of mine, Ada, who actually used to live in Isoka as well, but who'd been in the U.S. for a while. And this young woman had helped her in the store. And when she was checking out, the cashier said, did somebody help you? And there were two young women who were helping. One was white, one was black. Every other thing was the same. They both had long black hair. They were both dressed in black. And so she said to Ada, who helped you? And Ada says, oh, I don't remember her name. And she says, was it the one with the long hair? And Ada said, both of them had long hair. She's like, was it the one wearing the pants? Ada goes, both of them were wearing pants. And I remember standing there thinking, surely, we know. There's something very obviously different between the two. Why? But for me, it was a learning moment. You know, one of those moments when you realize, so this is how race works in America. We're all supposed to pretend. Right? So I'm colorblind. I'm just thinking, it's so absurd. And, you know, it's... But really, I think there's a lot of, and because, I mean, in some ways, and I also don't want to be flippant, because I understand that this country has a terrible, terrible history, and present, really, that's just horrible about race. And so I understand in some ways that kind of discomfort comes from that, but I don't know that it necessarily helps. But I don't know that pretending makes something somehow, you know, I don't know that pretending that these two people are not different then means that they're not.
Right.
It seems to me that America hasn't quite come, and this is me, of course, as a foreigner, I'm looking in, and so I've been assigned black, but I had to learn how to be black, and like you said, I had to learn to be that I was supposed to be offended by certain things. So in undergrad, somebody made a joke about, somebody said something to an African American girl in my class and said fried chicken, and people said, oh my God, and I was confused. You know, I thought, what's wrong with fried chicken? I'm like, why is that a bad thing? And even my asking was not well received. So even my saying, wait, why? People are like, oh, no. You know? And it's not, you know, really, and so I think that layers of silence cover things, and half the time people are not saying what they think. People are curious about things, but they don't say.
Right.
People, you know, so it becomes this very prickly, strange thing, and really the only way to deal with it is to avoid it. But then I think that resentments simmer because it doesn't, you know, they don't go away, and the pretending that things are not what they are just, so I am fascinated by race in America. Fascinated by it. And also by the euphemisms that people, you know, often Americans will say culture, but they really mean race.
Yes.
Right? They'll be like, you know, I just think this man who was talking about his daughter dating a black man, and he said, no, I don't have a problem. It's just that it's a different culture. And I thought, the boy is an American, middle class, educated. I'm not quite sure how the culture is different. He just happens to be black. But he's like the culture. And it's such a, I find it fascinating. So I wanted to say, many of the things that often one is not supposed to say, because I think also what's very interesting to me about the US is how there's a lot of silencing. I mean, America prides itself on the surface about being a country of free speech, but really, it's a country in which people, you learn from the time that you're in elementary school not to say many things. And I think that where it becomes even more institutionalized is in college. Colleges, it's really about silence, really. It's about, it really is. And I was struck by it. And so I wanted this book to be, you know, where I sort of say things that I think a lot of people think, and but won't say.
Right.
and I thought the blog would be, and also in some ways it was like inhabiting an entirely different persona, because that voice is not mine.
Yes.
I couldn't even read those things aloud because I wouldn't sound authentic. I don't know how to be that voice. but it was fun to write because I was stepping outside of myself and just sort of, you know, also I wanted to make fun of the way that some immigrants, black immigrants from the Caribbean and from Africa come to the US and say, oh, I'm not black.
Right.
Rex, I'm like, you are black, darling.
Yeah.
Because if you... I mean, really, you know, and also I think that there's... And I'm also very interested in that, you know, that the... So on the one hand, many immigrants who are black, who come to the US, if I were a dictator in the US... Actually, I'd like to be a dictator in this country.
That would be a good job. Better than being a dictator in Nigeria, where you could get shot.
You know what I would do if I were a dictator? I'll get all the women in the US to have afros. So for white women, would have to find something to make their hair stand. I think it'd be fantastic. But another thing I would do is I would force every black immigrant to take a course in African American history.
Yes,
I think it's too. Really, because many of us come here and we don't know, and there isn't something automatic about blackness. Just because you look like this doesn't mean that you understand America's race thing.
Right.
And so many of these immigrants come and they very easily absorb all the horrible stereotypes about African Americans. And so there's just this horrible misunderstanding where people have just really stupid ideas. And then on the other hand, I feel that African Americans often expect immigrants who are black to know what it means to be black in America.
Right.
And often they don't. Mm-hmm. And so I was also really interested in that. And I think in some ways when immigrants say, oh, I'm not black, it's not just a way of sort of separating themselves from something they know isn't good. Because really, we know that to be black in America is not exactly fun. Right?
Right.
So these immigrants are like, no, I'm not black, I'm from Jamaica. No, don't call me black, right? And I'm very interested in that. So, you know, so there's a blog post about me making fun of that.
Yeah.
I understand where it comes from, but I wish it just wasn't there. I mean, I wish I just wish there was a better, I don't know, cohesion, understanding, whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I became black in America,
thank you, America.
I'm still learning I'm still learning to be offended about certain things because sometimes I have to be honest and say that it becomes almost for example, you know, people in this country get hung up on things like, oh, there was a noose in an office, but nobody's talking about the real serious structural problems. So I'm a lot more interested in how and why it is that, you know, certain people use a certain kind of drug and get incredible jail sentences, and certain people use a certain kind of drug and don't get the same sentences.
Exactly.
I feel that that's what should be talked about, but there's a kind of sensationalizing of very minor, silly racial things in this country and ignoring the real issues. And I've always been struck by that as well, because I think it's another way of, it's a larger example of that woman saying, was it the one with the long hair? Because it's, you know, it's it's forgetting what's really fundamental and dealing with things like, oh, noose.
Right, yeah.
But anyway.
Or just the kind of political correctness that goes on in the college classroom, spending so much time, you know, dissecting words. And you know,
like,
meanwhile, if you just go outside the gate, particularly where I live, you can just see people being shot all the time.
I think I mean, where you, and in many places, and actually in many of the cities where the very good schools are.
Yeah.
Right. So there's a lot of talk inside the classroom about how a ward has to be deconstructed and how it. And I'm just thinking, but. My question is, why is that inner city the way that it is? What's the history of it? How did that happen?
Mm-hmm.
And what's going to be done? And what's about, you know, let's talk about policy and the possibilities of policy, that sort of thing, right? But nobody wants to. Instead, we'll talk about the deconstructing of a word. Anyway, I'll stop there.
You definitely have to read the blog entries. They're one of my favorite things. They're so lovely. And I really appreciate that, because that was one of the things that was hardest for me about going to Nigeria was the kind of questions people would ask about black Americans. And I realized that you know, our father's generation, I think they knew because they were right there on the heels of the civil rights movement. So they knew Americans had died so they could be here. But now there's this huge, you know, chasm. And you know, a lot of it's from the white press. And then also, you know, I've had friends tell me that they encourage you, like when you come here, they'll encourage you to think that you're special and you're different. You'll get a lot of reward. If you don't identify as well. And so people get, you know, seduced by that.
I mean, I know that for being, there's a certain privilege in being a black person, but who is not, who's a foreigner. So I've had many people say things to me like, and the reason I resent, deeply resent being told things of this sort is because it's, I feel that I'm being made complicit in something I don't want to be a part of. So when they say things to me like, you're different, you don't have issues, you're not angry. It's very offensive. Very offensive.
Because just wait a wait a few minutes.
Yeah, and
I know. In some way, somebody in the UK said to me, "Oh, isn't this is an angry book, isn't it?" And I said to her, "Darling, I can do angry, but I haven't done it here." Right. So, but we know when people say you're not angry, you don't have issues. You know what they're saying. They're sort of what they're saying is you're the good Negro. That's what they're saying.
Exactly.
And the reason I find it offensive is I don't have the same history as the people that these that you're maligning. And by saying that to me, what you're doing is you're discounting the validity of the history that's really still not even just a history, still very present. I read African American history and I just think, oh my Lord. It's not that long ago. I just read things and it's incredible to me what happened in this country. And anyway.
Oh, there's so much I want to say too. And there is this, I wanted to have this whole conversation about black travel writing, which we don't have time for, but I love that there's a character in the book who's writing a book called Traveling While Black and does make this statement about how native blacks are always treated worse than non-native blacks everywhere in the world, which kind of has a Jamaica Kincaidish ring to it. But you'll just have to find that on your own because I think we have to switch to questions now. Am I correct? Okay, thank you so much.
My question is, when writing, how often did your characters dictate what you wrote? And how often was it very much different than what you had planned to write?
Good question. Because even that I don't know. I often start off not knowing how my stories will end. I have a vague idea of what I want to do, but for me, the true joy of writing is that it's a discovery, it's a journey. I don't know what's going to happen at the end. With Americana, I very much wanted what happened at the end to happen. So whether I then forced my will on them toward the end, maybe, but really, in the middle of the book, there were things that choices Ifemelu made that I didn't necessarily approve of or want her to make. It's. I think people who write understand this, because when you say it to people who don't write, my family, nobody writes. And so when I tell them things like, oh, my characters took over, they look at me like, like, should we find a psychiatrist? But yeah, so I think it's a balance. And because for me, the process isn't entirely conscious, it's hard even to know. You know, it's hard to say, really, when it happens and when it doesn't. And
question over here.
My question is, I read that you started, that at Insuka you went to school for like 1.5 years reading medicine and pharmacy, but when you got to this country, you actually switched to writing. At what point did you know that medical line is not really what you want to do, that is writing?
I always knew that I wanted to write. Writing has always been what I loved and what I really wanted to do. But growing up in Nigeria, I didn't think I could ever earn a living from writing. So my plan, and also, of course, I'm sure that you know, when you do well in school in Nigeria, they tell you, oh, you have to be a doctor. So I sort of just went along with it because that's what happens. You do well in school, you go into medicine. And my plan was that I would become a psychiatrist and then I would use my patient stories to write my books. That really was my plan. Because
I thought this was the best thing I could do. This was how to make the best of both situations. And but after about a year of medicine, I just realized you have to care. And I think it's a very noble profession, but you really deeply have to be invested in it. It's not just about doing well in school. You have to care. And I didn't. And so I left. And, no, but really. I was worried about being, you know, the possibility of my being responsible for inadvertent deaths of innocent people. But so I, one of the reasons I wanted to leave and come to the US was that I just wanted to leave the study of not just medicine, but science. Because in my whole secondary school science, you know, it was all science, and I was in the science track, and there was just no way I could leave and do something else. So really, coming to the US was my way of fleeing the study of science. I wanted to study history and literature, and I wanted to, you know, and philosophy and political science. Those are the things I really cared about. But when I was in secondary school, that's what you did if you weren't bright. Which I think is one of the failings of our education system. Yeah.
Hmm. Hi, my question is, I have a perception that there's been a change where African women are wearing their hair straight or wearing hair that didn't come out of their heads. What has changed that has, because when I was in college, this wasn't the case. But what has changed that African women are straightening their hair and wearing other people's hair? And well, one quick question, where did you get those green shoes from?
I'm sorry.
Where did you get those shoes?
More to the point.
We can talk afterwards. But by the way, women who wear, I mean, if they pay for it, it's really kind of their hair. But that's interesting, actually, because I think, I don't know what's happened. I think it's not just about straightening the hair. It's also that really now we don't much care for our own hair, whether natural or straightened. Now there's lots of sort of long weaves that trail all the way down. I don't know, maybe it's Beyoncé. Maybe it's the Beyoncification of Africa. I really don't know. But it's something that has. I remember when I was in secondary school, I couldn't wait to do the relax and straighten my hair. But 2 years after secondary school, it was buying Chinese weave to do the Chinese weave. That was the thing that I really longed for. And it's very much the norm now that. It's the norm. You just go, you know, I'm going to go do my hair often means I'm going to go put in a weave. And which also often means that caring for our own hair and even just, you know, just getting a conditioner or a steam or something just doesn't happen anymore. Many of the hairdressers in Lagos know how to take care of weaves, but they don't know how to take care of hair.
Wow.
Yeah. It's actually it's slightly changing. There's a small but growing movement of natural hair, which, you know, not surprisingly, I am a big part of.
We have a question over here.
Yay. Yes, thank you for being with us tonight. I had a question about the differences between neo-colonial Nigeria and America. And I imagine there are also the layers, there's also the heartbreaks, there's also at the cultural intersections kind of cultural blindness that's practiced. And I'm just curious what your perspective is on the biggest differences between Nigerian society around those points compared to American.
So this is kind of the question of, well, you can't just talk about our pathology, what about your pathology?
Right.
So I shall now talk about Nigerian pathology. I think the one major difference really is that when I talk about not thinking about myself, that one of the reasons I'm fascinated by the permutations of race in America is that I never thought of myself as black in Nigeria. I didn't need to. Race wasn't a way of identifying. Ethnicity was. So I was very much aware that I was an Igbo girl. But I think one of the major difference between that, and both, I mean, prejudices based on both are really messed up. But the difference, I think, is that the immediacy of race, and by race I mean skin color. My younger brother is very light-skinned. We have the same parents, but he came out very light-skinned. And I think if we lived in South Africa, he would be considered a different race. I think they would call him colored. Yeah. Which in itself is ridiculous. And I think what it says, for me, what it shows is how absurd race
is. But ethnicity isn't immediate. So if I walk into a bank in Lagos, for example, you can't tell that I'm Igbo just by looking at me. I could be anything. And if I chose not to use my Igbo name, you still couldn't tell. So I could decide that my name in Nigeria is Rose Brown. And you just couldn't tell whether I was Igbo. And so if somebody in the bank, for example, didn't want to give loans to Igbo people, they couldn't discriminate against me because they wouldn't know what I was. But the immediacy of race, and the reason it's absurd and interesting for me, is it's so immediate. So if you walk into a bank in the US and somebody has decided that dark-skinned people are not good for bank loans, for example, it's immediate. You sort of walk in and already the decision has been made. And I think also in Nigeria, there's an overtness to people's prejudices, which, I mean, not that it's necessarily better, but, you know, often Nigerians are quick to tell you things like, Igbo people are so money-grubbing, right? Yoruba people are so loud. And sometimes somebody will do something and they'll be like, yeah, but that's not surprising. You know, she's Yoruba. That's why. So there's a kind of overtness to the prejudice, like, oh, yeah, why is it that surprising? But, you know, the ethnicity explains the behavior. And so there isn't... I mean, it is layered still, but there's a greater overtness to it. And I don't know whether it's more troubling or less troubling. So I know a friend, for example, who wanted to get a flat in Lagos. And the landlord said very clearly to her, I don't like to rent to Igbo people. And so she sat there looking at him. Like, but she said, you know, I have a job I can pay. And he goes, no, I don't like to rent to Igbo people. And you know, you're just like, but yeah, it's...
Hello.
Hello.
One of my favorite books is Half of a Yellow Sun, and I think I just recently read somewhere that it's being made into a movie. And I'm curious to know how involved you've been in that process, or what your take on it becoming a movie is.
First of all, thank you. It's lovely to know that. thank you. And for me, actually, it's very moving. Half of Yellow Sun. It meant so much to me, that book. And you know, that in Nigeria, that it meant a lot to people, for many people, for whom it became more than literature, it became history, yes. Right? And so it's even more moving for me that it means something to non-Nigerians. It's, I find it makes me very happy, so thank you. I was not involved in the film. I didn't want to be involved in the cutting up of my baby, really. Half of Yellow Sun is my baby, absolutely. Mm. And I think film is such a different medium. And, you know, I was happy that it was being made into a film, I suppose. But I'm just really, I just think books are better than films. And I know that, no, really. And I just wish, I wish people would be more excited about, I wish people would be as excited about books as they are about film. So when the film was being cast, for example, I'm told that many Nigerians were very upset because the woman who was cast in the lead role was not Nigerian. And so I'm told that there were petitions signed online and movements launched. And my first question was, all of these people who are involved in these petitions, did they buy the book? And I don't think they did. But I think it comes out later this year. I think it's going to be launched in a number of film festivals. I'm not involved. I wasn't involved at all, but I have seen the film. It's a very good film, yes. The director, who's a friend of mine, actually, whose name is B. Bandele, I think it's a very good film. It's very different from the book in many ways, but I think it's a beautiful film. So look for it when it comes out.
We have a question over here. Over here.
First of all, thank you for your advocacy of encouraging people to take African American studies, quote, to learn how to be black. You have to understand the underlying economics of the issue. There's a 1662 law that said that the status of the child was that of the mother. And that governed American politics up through and past the Civil War. I'm going to ask the question, but I must continue.
All right. I just...
And the significance of the noose. You must be able to encourage people to read the NAACP's 30 Years of Lynching. And then you will understand what that noose meant, particularly to black men. My question is for you. Please, will you continue to advocate this? And don't back down.
I will keep that in mind. But I do have to say that it's not to diminish the significance of the news. It's just to say that I felt that the way it was talked about, it became less about really serious underlying issues and just more about a kind of very vapid outrage that it seemed to me just didn't. It became about, oh, look, there's a noose under my chair, rather than, and half the time I thought, do people even understand why it's supposed to be a thing of outrage? So it's not to say that I don't understand, because I have read quite a bit about the history of lynchings and all. So it's not to say that I'm diminishing the significance of it, but it's just to say that I think, in a larger sense, the conversations people have about race in this country often focuses on the surface and on a kind of very empty, histrionic, just outrage.
Hi, how are you? Haven't read the book yet, but I'm excited to get started. I wanted to ask the question, I'm really impressed with your connection and empathy and understanding of African-American people, culture, et cetera, but I couldn't help but think, I've never been to Africa, and I know you're not the spokesperson for all of Africa, but...
I want my money back.
But I was wondering, is there this... We understand that we came from African people. I mean, if you read African American history, the Igbo are constantly talked about and how they, you know, were resilient and rebellious and, you know, difficult to capture and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But is there an understanding, I'll say, in your community that we are just descendants far removed from them? Is it the same way? Is it the reverse? Or do people from your community, your village, your experience in Nigeria understand that we are very much connected to them, just a few generations removed, as we understand it about Africans? Does that make sense?
So I shall now ascend my position as spokesperson for all of Africa. And in that position, I'm happy to assure you that my fellow Africans, all, I don't know, how many, 500 million of us?
Give or take a few.
We know that African-American history did not start on the slave ship. It started on the continent of Africa. We know that.
You've been placed in a tradition along with writers like Uzodinma Irwala, maybe Jhumpa Lahiri, as Anglophone writers who represent not just North America or the UK, but let's say, in your case, Nigeria, India, or what have you. I'm wondering how you feel about being placed alongside those other writers, for whatever reason, whether it's the content or just the fact that you and Uzo are from the same place. Even though he grew up in the States. How do you feel about being placed in that tradition, and how do you feel, or where do you feel your place is?
I don't think about my work in that way, and I don't think about where I'm placed and who's placed. And quite frankly, I didn't know that I was supposed to be placed with... Did you say Jhumpa Lahiri? I didn't know that. I mean, I think that as a writer, that I could look at my work as a critic, or I could look at my work as a creative person, and I choose to look at my work as a creative person. I think it's the critic's job to talk about things such as tradition and placing people. And I also realize that having read some critics and where they place writers, I often very strongly disagree with these placements and with these, because sometimes it's less about the subject, sometimes it's more about where you've come from. So they sort of group, if you've all come from Nigeria, they put you all together, even if somebody's work is so different. And so I don't think about that. I really don't. I'm not sure that I can answer the question, because it's not something that I find interesting. I just don't really think about that.
Take two more questions.
Right up here. I am a blogger online. I am a natural hair blogger.
All
so
right.
To speak. My website is called Afrolicious, but I don't blog about natural hair. And so people come. So to me, it was really thrilling to encounter the blog in your book, the function of a blog and the way it constructs our identities and tells stories across time, across space, and across the digital realm. So my question to you is, where did you get this idea to use the blog in such a phenomenal way? Because a lot of activism happens on the blog. A lot of definition takes place on the blog. A lot of anger and conversation and reconstructing of histories and learning about histories happens throughout the blogosphere, both the Nigerian blogosphere, the African-American blogosphere. How did you come up with that function?
I used to be an avid blog reader. I think I might have read yours, actually. Afrolicious. I think so. So I haven't in a while because I'm trying to reduce my internet consumption because I find that it gets in the way of my ability to write. So I'm trying to sort of, you know, stay away from the internet. But I used to read blogs a lot, and partly for research, really, just sort of reading blogs as an anthropologist, because I think it's also a very often it's an honest space. It's where people say what they think, and I found it very interesting. So I read a lot of feminist blogs, a lot of natural hair blogs. There's a blog I mentioned in the book, which for a long time was my favorite blog, and it's called Post Bougie. It's this fantastic, I don't know if anybody read it, but it's this really wonderful blog but now it's kind of slowed down. I don't think they're... But anyway, so yeah, I got the idea from reading blogs. I've never blogged, but I'm an admirer of bloggers and a very keen reader of blogs. So I got the idea, and just reading them, there's, you know, it's that the honesty of it, the immediacy of it, the way that you can really do anything with the form, that the blog is such a flexible form, and that you can do anything with it, and that also it can be quite powerful. And unlike a novel, you don't need the publisher, the editor. There's something about it that's quite raw. And I wanted to. So that's that really, it was just from reading blogs that... So I thank bloggers like you for the inspiration. There was a woman who had her... Oh, but there's a woman who's had her hand up for a while.
I just wanted to say, first of all, that this is a love story that I will carry with me for the rest of my life. And only because it hasn't been brought up, the issue of language seems to be something, somewhat of a preoccupation of the main characters, yes. Kind of how language isn't used properly or how Americans may be corrupted. And I just thought if you would address that for a moment.
Good. I didn't say that. Ifemelu did. Oh, and by the way, thank you. I love that you, because I, you know, there is a kind of my desire to, because I think deep down I'm quite a hopeless romantic, but I like to hide it. And so for me, it was also that even I, in writing some Obinze and Ifemelu passages, I think, right, I'd be so moved in a really ridiculous way with the loveness of it, the lushness, the ridiculousness of it. I wanted that kind of love that's just, you know, the love that it's first love, and it's the love that makes you fully who you are, and all of that nonsense. So yeah, I'm happy that you share that. but language is very important to me, and also I'm very interested in the. And because I grew up bilingual, and I consider both Igbo and English my first languages, and I'm constantly moving between the two, and there are times when I think of something and I can't express it. English is not sufficient, so it has to be in Igbo. And other times when I'm speaking Igbo, I can't really, you know, so then I go to English. And of course, my English is not an American English. And when I came to the US, I came with the slight arrogance of the person who was well versed in English. As my father would say, the Queen's English. So then I came to the US and I remember being struck by, what are these Americans saying? Right? First I thought they can't spell. Right? And of course what's terrible now is that my spelling is entirely American, which my father is horrified by. So when I write, and so if I write color, my father very gently will add the U. He's like, no, this is not the right spelling. So my spelling, but it was just, and I think it's the two Englishes. So in some ways for Ifemelu, and of course it's also about, it's language as
a way of communicating, but also language as an identity, a sense of identification, a sense of self. So Ifemelu, when she's early on, she starts to do a very good American accent. And then at some point, she lets go of it because it's one of those false layers that she has to let go of to become her real and authentic and true self. And so I think for me, language is not just language. Language can mean many other things. And actually, very much like Ifemelu, I did a very good American my first few years. Mm-hmm. And was very convincing over the phone, because that's when you know, when people think you're American on the phone. But when customer service people in stores think you're that's when you know you've sort of achieved the... But then I remember one day thinking to myself, I'm going to stop this. And my whole thing was, what will I, if there's an earthquake and you're asleep, and there's an earthquake and then you're woken up, right, and you're told there's an earthquake, in what accent will you speak? And whatever. And I said that, and I said, that's how I want to sound. But it's true though, and so in some ways.
Who thinks about this thing?
Well, it's true, that's what I thought. And I thought that's the, you know, and it's, but it's not, again, it's language, yes, but it's a deeper thing. It's about, at least for me, it was about just being true to myself, being who I am, because it takes so much more of an effort to be false. And you waste that energy of falseness that you could have channeled into, I think, more productive things. I think I started writing better when I stopped doing my American accent. It's true. And you know, so my whole life I said water. It takes an effort to say water. And so that extra energy that I have saved, I direct to my writing.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.